A recent Harris poll found 89% of Americans live in chronic stress. 89%. This is Conversations. If you're one of the nearly 9 out of 10 for whom life is no picnic these days, join us as we talk about one way to intervene on your own behalf. Our guest is educator and trainer Joseph Sundrum. We'll be talking about what's called freeze frame. Joseph, at a talk you gave recently, you talked about some statistics that I found mind-boggling. There were several sets. The one I'm thinking of is the amount of money we Americans spend on prescription drugs, drugs to deal with problems relating to stress. The figures were too large. I couldn't get my mind around them. Can you go back and track through that?
There were two sets of numbers that I talked about relative to our expenditures with prescription drugs. The first had to do with the cost. In 1991, this nation spent $4.3 billion. And that represents actually only 8 out of the top 10 selling prescription drugs. The filter there has to do with the prescription drugs that dealt directly with stress and managing stress through medication. That figure in 1992 went up, actually more than doubled, to $9.2 billion for the same 8 out of 10 top-selling prescription drugs. So it, on any level you look at, it's a tremendous hemorrhaging of the nation's wealth to deal with something that has become commonplace both in this nation and for people around the world, and that is, how do we cope with our own reactions to events, to our perceptions, to our experience of life in a way that toxifies us in the stress experience, and that has both physiological consequences and psychological consequences, and actually access to intelligence consequences, which is part of what I was referencing in mentioning those numbers. Additionally, there's very strong data to indicate that probably between 75 and 90% of all doctor visits are also directly related to stress. So we're seeing in a very broad sense that we as a culture, as a nation, as a society, have been hamstrung, have been undercut, have been really brought to a place where it is no longer just a phrase or a topic that people can say, yeah, I'm stressed out, mm-hmm. but rather it's something that is having really grave and deep consequences, not only at the individual level, how we live our lives, but at the systemic level, what we are doing as a nation.
What are we taking to the doctor? What are we asking for drugs to medicate? What's the problem on our plate, or groups of problems? How are we defining those?
Well, what we take to the doctor, I mean, in one of the arenas, and this is just one small slice of a larger picture, but for example, when people are stressed out, they pay less attention to what they're doing and get hurt more often. Mm-hmm. So a number of worksite and home site accidents are happening because we are preoccupied with other things while we stumble into a ladder or fall down the stairs or break our toe or our arm or something. But in a broader sense, what we're seeing is that both the pace of life and the reactions that we have to things that are going on around us that we register mentally and emotionally have reached a level that they are causing us both psychological and physical damage. And we can now begin to see and extrapolate from this information that there's damage to our social systems, our political systems. In fact, virtually every system, every infrastructure in this country suffers from the lack of coherence that stress creates in individuals.
Carry that through in some concrete way. Give me an example. I'm sure there are eyebrows arching when you say that stress is carrying over to the social fabric, the political fabric, etc.
Well, I mean, there's legions of examples, but I'll pick a couple. Mm-hmm. Simply in the issue of how local and state government run. We are seeing a level of vindictiveness in political advertising, in political process, that while it's not completely unusual in either American politics or international politics. It has reached a rather nasty phase where almost no campaign is without just a terribly demoralizing and very cutting language that not only permeates campaigns, but then permeates the way that elected officials do what they do. And what they are required to do is to take on their representation of quite different causes on behalf of the people they represent and come to some kind of consensus in dealing with what has become now leaner resources for greater needs, which in itself is a stressful situation. But how we do that process has broken down. A number of state legislatures, for example, have been having great difficulty in determining which of the many state or local needs is to be funded, which is to be cut back, and why. And so it becomes a platform for dialogue or diatribe. And I think we've seen much more diatribe than we have seen dialogue. And consequently, there's a tremendous inefficiency in the governmental process and tremendous cynicism that has grown in the public at large at our representatives and the way they conduct themselves, the caliber of their conversation and the caliber of their deliberations in these august bodies that has degenerated down to a mudslinging fest and a character-damaging fest, and it's permeated the television and radio waves, and it doesn't reflect well that the people who are there to carry out the will of their representative, the population, are not doing a very very good job. And I know they're all sincere and well-meaning people. This is not a slant or throwing darts at politicians, but there is a very broad sense of cynicism in the public at large. And this is just one isolated example. You were asking for a couple.
Mm-hmm.
So the political process is a good example. Another is you look at the educational process, and again, we see there's tremendous animosity that exists virtually at every level among the children, between children and teachers, among teachers, between teachers and administrators, among administrators, between administrators and central office, between the central office and the state. And it has to do with budget issues and policy issues and curriculum issues and personnel issues. And more the decisions that are taken in those realms have the unfortunate tendency to create more divisiveness than cohesiveness. And so we have a lot of people who are laboring on behalf of their communities in a losing game. And the net result is that there's more and more polarization happening. There's more and more a sense of what's the point on the part of a lot of people who've dropped out of the political process. For being one of the largest democracies in the world, we have one of the weakest turnouts in terms of that population exercising its right to make choices through the ballot box. These are all indications that some examples of how stress has affected us and how it basically has turned many people off, turned them inward, and they're not getting relief. Basically, our research work is about redefining how stress affects the individual, and that it's really an inside job, if you will. It's our reaction in the mental and emotional domains to both events outside of ourselves and self-created events. In that, I mean revisiting different incidents or dialogues inside your own thought process or feeling process.
Joseph Sundrum is with us today on Conversations. When he says our research, he's talking about the Heart Math Institute. That's one word, two words combined together to make one, Heart Math. The Heart Math Institute is located in Boulder Creek, California, in the Santa Cruz Mountains, south of San Francisco, just north of Santa Cruz. And Joseph Sundrum is the executive director of a branch of that institute called the Government Education Community Division of the Institute of Heart Math. Joseph Sundrum with us today on Conversations. He's in Fairbanks for a training with the Alaska Staff Development Network, working with Interior Alaska Secondary School educators. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. I hear two things in your examples, at least I think I do. Tell me if these are there and what else might be there. One is an increasingly complex society that seems to be spinning out of the hands of its members. And on the members' part, hopelessness, alienation from problem-solving abilities. It's all too much. I feel us holding our heads. And then that second thing I hear you saying is that we then are kind of turning to each other with talons out and saying, it's your fault, Hank. You did it, Joseph, instead of looking at the problem. Is that part of what's going on? It's just all getting too much for us?
It has gotten too much for us. And again, it's the spilling out from the inside out, meaning that we all make meaning individually. We all ingest the events, our perceptions of life, take them in, and give them some relationship to our world, our personal worlds. And we take our personal worlds out in what we do professionally and how we treat people in our personal lives, how we raise children, how we maintain a sense of community, how we are with our friends. And, of course, the quality of what we deliver in the professional context, whatever our work might be. So in that sense, you're really right that it has both a very broad effect in terms of the cumulative or accumulative effect. But where it really plays out and where it springs from is in the relationship of a person in themselves and how they deal with the influx of information from the outside and also the recycling of information within their own system. And how through that whole process we make meaning, we find balance, how we place ourselves on the continuum between peace and pain.
The continuum between peace and pain. Tell me what you perceive is happening on the individual level then, the thing that is creating the energy that goes outward. What's going on in there? What's that stress look like to you?
Well, we've been able to actually quantify it on a physiological level, interestingly enough, by doing spectral analysis of the EKG signal, in other words, the electrical signal of the heart. We all know what the heartbeat looks like. We've probably seen it on monitors and in hospitals and on TV shows. That's the first level of analysis, that you can actually look at this electrical output of the heart. There's a more sophisticated process called spectral analysis that gives you kind of an ingredient structure of what's going on in that heartbeat. And in that level of analysis, you get a whole lot of information. Curiously, all this information falls into one of two categories. It can either be incoherent, meaning that there is no order or high degree of disorder, or it could be coherent. In other words, there is harmonic qualities to it. It's ordered. It's actually pretty to look at. It looks like a chord sounds, a harmonic chord sounds. And the experience of stress, whether that's through frustration, irritation, anger, what have you, mm-hmm. generates incoherent electrical signals. Now, why this is important is that the heart is actually 40 to 60 times more powerful than the electrical output of the brain or, in fact, any other part of the body.
So it beats the system.
That's correct. Its signal is by far the most dominant electrical signal in the whole body. So it is a great place to get a sort of a meta-analysis of what's going on in the electrical human being. And since so very much of our system is driven by these electrical fields, whether that be how information is passed through the autonomic nervous system, which is electrical information, or how our cells work, all the way down to the atomic level, human beings are essentially electrical beings. So to have a signal of this power, 40 to 60 times greater power than that being produced by the brain, the content of that signal then takes on far greater importance. If it's incoherent, that signal at 60 times the intensity of any other signal in the body is going out to every cell carrying incoherent information, with biochemical changes resulting from that, with a whole host of immunological, hormonal, physiological changes based on that.
Does this take us right back to the doctor then? I mean, is that what we're carrying to our physician and saying, I'm just going crazy, I'm so depressed, I have headaches, I have...
That's certainly part of it, but it's even if we're not going to the doctor, it's what's taking us away from our fulfillment and deeper into the pain side of the continuum, further away from the peace side of the continuum. And because this is not a subject that is taught to human beings as part of being a human being, how do you manage yourself? How do you manage your reactivity to life? Because we register peace or pain in the mental and emotional domain. If you think about it, when you're peaceful, your thoughts are clear and lucid, and your emotions are balanced. When you are frustrated, or when you are in any other area relative to this feeling of being away from peace and closer to pain, then our thinking process is probably happening at a high velocity and with not a whole lot of clarity or lucidity, and our emotions are all up and down and all over the place, and in many cases are running us more than we're running them. And it's very hard in a context like that to set your goal on something and actually do it, because you have constant inner distraction. Very hard to focus. And we're seeing this in children. We're seeing it in adults. Children's test scores have fallen off. Their sense of themselves is much weaker in many, many cases, meaning that they are seeking to align themselves with other kids in a way that sort of helps them make meaning of their place in the scheme of things. One of the things that I've been working with is children who are in gangs, from elementary school kids to middle school kids to high school kids. And it's a very powerful draw into a power center outside of oneself, because we haven't been able to deliver to children a way for them to find that place of balance and peace within themselves, and fun being a real important part of that, but belongingness being a real key. Mm-hmm. They are looking for the family that comes after the biological family and will give almost anything for that kind of acceptance.
And this is I'm following up on your coherent heartbeat. This is a notion of coherence that a gang is a notion of coherence that gives you a place to stand on the planet, right? Tells you who you are, makes yourself coherent. You're a raven, or you're a buck, or whatever.
That's great. And, right. And it's also, I mean, on a very simple level, we all want to belong. I mean, we don't want to feel like we are oxygen thieves, that we don't have a right to the air that we breathe, that we really have a place that we take a stand in life. But drawing this all back to our conversation first on stress, the incoherent electrical output, which can be measured in the physical heart while people are in various states of stress, has that physiological damaging quality. In other words, it puts us into a place of imbalance in the way that our body works. And it also affects the ability for the mind to focus, the ability for the mind to problem solve, to access its creativity or its intuitive capabilities, to make decisions that have a broader scope than immediate gratification or the expediency of the moment, but can really take the long look. And of course, when you're in pain, the most driving thing is just to get out of pain. Mm-hmm. And we're not necessarily looking for what will be the best choice, 5 years down the road. We just want to stop hurting now. And incoherence is not a pleasant experience. I mean, although many of us have become inured to it, we've become practiced at it. We're stress athletes, in a sense. So we're not even as perceptive of how deeply in stress we live, because it's become normal to us.
This is Joseph Sundram. He was born and raised in Bombay and is a first-generation immigrant to the United States. He took his master's in education from Harvard. Among his careers, and for a relatively young man, he's had several. He has been a teacher, a high school principal, the youngest at that time American high school principal. He was a high school principal at the age of 25. He has been a counselor and a director of youth and human service organizations. He talked about working with gangs in Los Angeles. He worked with the LA Gang Risk Intervention Pilot Projects and with teen gang members and their counselors, both in Los Angeles and in Phoenix. He's gained some national recognition for his work in violence prevention, and he's worked with correctional staff and incarcerated adults and juveniles in detention facilities in the states of California, Colorado, and in Georgia. Joseph Sundram with us today on Conversations. We're talking about stress. Joseph, in America, we have this notion that there is good stress, that the some stresses, the little stress is good for you. Can you respond to that? Is that true in any way from your point of view?
I'd frame it as creative resistance. One way of looking at the so-called good stress is, yeah, there's some people who function very well under deadlines and under pressures. And what would distinguish the two really is the net result on our own systems. Certainly to have something to shoot for is a good incentive, whether that's a deadline or it can galvanize our forces and give us something very clear to put our energy behind. However, the kind of stress I'm speaking about is the more pervasive, either low-grade to high-grade kind that people live with day in and day out, that is driven by a sense of, in many cases, judgment or frustration or aggravation, irritation, incompletion, the kind of experience that robs us of clarity of focus, that robs us of a sense of our place, that robs us of fulfillment, that robs us of our health. And that kind of stress, which is the more pervasive kind, doesn't do anything for us, really. As I mentioned, the good stress, if you will, is that gives us the incentive, the pressure, the goal setting. And sometimes that's done artificially, sometimes it's not. But that gives people the impetus to move towards that which they really want to manifest.
And I think the point you're making is that we ignore or don't pay enough attention to the levels of stress we're constantly living with at our peril. I mean, we're losing a lot. Hemorrhaging, I think, was the word you used earlier. Mm-hmm. Why don't we know how to manage stress? Is this a point of cultural evolution where things are more complicated than they've ever been before? Or have we backslid? Or what's your read on why we don't manage stress well?
Well, there's a subject for a several-hour conversation about why those changes have occurred and what those all are. And there are many of them, but clearly there's been an information revolution. There's much more variety of information bombarding everyone from little children all the way through adults. There's also been the loss of the real strength in many, many places of the very tight extended family bond. And so I think there is a sense that one other key aspect of it, in my view, is also the pervasiveness of media imagery as a model from which we measure ourselves and find ourselves wanting, because it's always laid out in a either body style or wardrobe style that is accessible really only to a very, very few. So there's a sense of not enough. There's a sense of never good enough that is being ingested by people of all ages at some very deep levels. And because it's happening subtly, we don't sit there watching a show and say, you know, I'll never be that good. But on some level, there's a sense that, you know, my house doesn't look like that. My family doesn't talk like that. We don't go out and have those kinds of experiences. I don't have clothes like that, which is true for a lot of people. But I think a much more fundamental reason for that is that the world really has changed, and the process of helping people adapt to that change has not kept pace, either in the educational process or in the work environment. We're simply presumed to show up with the skills necessary to deal with the changed circumstance, both in the educational and in the professional environment. And there are, for many, many people, no formal vehicles of training them for that kind of capacity to adapt. And so consequently, we see now we're in a crisis of flexibility, among other things, that we've become stuck in certain patterns and they're comfortable, even though they may not be working. And to deal with change is a very frightening and scary process. It's a uncomfortable process for many people. And so there's tremendous resistance to change, which cannot be held back. So it's...
Are all these things why the HeartMath Institute was founded and what drew you there? I mean, is that what's going on with you as well as with this institute?
Well, the institute was really created to be a research and training center for putting the heart back into the people business. And that is definitely why I became affiliated with it some 3 years ago. I was intrigued by the research and by the experience of really having the capacity hardwired into every human being to find that place of balance and fulfillment, that capacity to adapt and flex, the capacity to grow and move into more and more complex domains with more and more grace and poise, and to be able to not only acquire that for myself, but to give it to other people in all these different walks of lives, from education to government to corporations to the military to corrections to health, it just goes on. Mm-hmm. In all these different walks of life, the skills to meet the contingencies of our age and the challenges of our age. And so I think that's a very powerful, both personal experience and a powerful organizational mission to bring work of this caliber to all these places in need and in need of really retooling themselves. To me, the work is no less than reinventing human beings from the inside out, and not as something that someone else will do to me or I will do to them, but rather that something they can choose from their insides out to begin to understand the real power available through their own heart, and begin to express that in a way that brings more fulfillment into each individual life.
Talk to me about the heart as your focus. You've talked about it as a physiological center of great power, but what you're talking about is not just physiological. You're talking about the heart in dimensions we've not yet approached. Can you take a look at those for us from the heart math perspective?
Well, what we're really saying is the heart is an integral part of human decision-making, human choice-making, human intuition, and human intelligence. And we can see, just as an example, on a very casual level, that someone may have done something to make us very angry, and we may have all the righteousness behind why we're angry with them. We've asked them to do something, they promised to do it, whatever. And here we are at this point, they didn't do it, and we're angry. Now, before we go confront that person, probably almost everyone listening to this program has had the experience of being in this position. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, occasionally, instead of dropping on them like a ton of bricks, something will shift inside of us and take us to a place of understanding or compassion. And we'll wonder, yes, we're disappointed that they didn't do what was necessary, and we might be angry or frustrated about it, but we'll wonder what they're going through. And in that shift from our own frustration to a sense of walking a mile in their shoes, wanting to know what's going on in their experience, in other words, experiencing compassion, which is a quality of the heart, our perspective shifts. And as our perspective shifts, we deal with them in a completely different way. Instead of being accusatory, instead of being angry, instead of being condemning or condescending, we're much more open and let them know that this didn't feel good for us and what's going on for them. And somehow the net result of a heart-based dialogue is a completely different outcome than what we would call a head-based attack. Because the attack will make you defensive and it will build even more distance between two people. But a heart-based dialogue actually dissolves some of that animosity. And even where the dialogue began around an issue of conflict, where it ends is in the domain of communication and connection. And as I say, probably everybody listening to this has had both kinds of experiences.
And the interesting thing to me as you're saying this is, as I close my eyes and listen to you talk about the difference between a head-based reaction and a heart-based reaction, I intuitively know exactly what you mean, physically and psychically.
Right. And what we're saying is really far more energy efficient to operate from the heart in more and more moments of our lives. Now, this does not mean showing up for victimization. It does not mean that you can never get business done. It does not mean any of those things, because in a sense, our own understanding of the word heart has been terribly skewed. We've made it out to be this thing that gets broken, that you wear on your sleeve and therefore you are taken advantage of, that makes you show up in life as a doormat who can never stand up for oneself. That is not the real heart. The real heart is capable of taking care of business with poise and grace. But take care of business, it does. That's its bottom line. But it can do so in a way that builds rather than destroys. And it does so in a way that allows for clean, true communication to happen. Just on the subject of communication, if you were to look at how many people today are squelching something they need to say to somebody that's really backed up in their own system and is causing them stress because they cannot tell their truth or will not tell their truth because they don't know how, or they feel like the timing's never right, or they want to hurt somebody's feeling, or they're way too angry to talk about it now. For all those reasons, just on the subject of communication alone, huge volumes of stress could be released if people actually made the shift from sort of where we want to be at the head attack level to moving to a place of deep heart communication. And this is some of what's laid out in a number of the books and publications that we've put out, how one does deep heart communication, because it is a tremendous release. It builds rather than destroys. It connects rather than separates. And part of the problem here in our society, we were talking about politics earlier, is the communication process has been one of attack. It's a head-based communication process. I look good if I make you look bad, is the paradigm we're working with. Well, there's another far more effective paradigm where we can get business done and walk away, if not friends, at least respectful of one another's integrity in holding divergent opinions. And that part of both the political and the personal process, professional process, has been lost somehow. We've set up win-lose games. And actually, those have turned out to be lose-lose games. So what we're suggesting is by a very simple but very profound shift from the head to the heart, we can now begin to have far more effective communication, far more effective interaction with one another that creates truly win-win, grow-grow games.
This is Joseph Sundrum. He's representing the Heart Math Institute from Boulder Creek, California. He mentioned books. I'll mention two that I have seen. One is just out in the summer of 1994 by the founder of the Heart Math Institute. His name is Doc Lou Childer. I'll spell that at the end of the hour. His latest book is called Freeze Frame. We'll talk about freeze framing in just a minute as a verb, freeze framing. An earlier book that a friend loaned to me by Sarah Pattison, also associated with the Institute, kind of the second in command there, isn't she? Yeah. This is called The Hidden Power of the Heart, Achieving Balance and Fulfillment in a Stressful World. Both of these books are put out by Planetary Publications. All the books are put out by Planetary Publications. You can reach that company at P.O. Box 66, Boulder Creek, California, 95006. When you're talking about deep heart communication, is there a book associated with that?
No, but it's referenced in both of these books.
Okay. It comes through in these pages. Let's talk about a skill for the 90s, if you will, or maybe for the 21st century more accurately, and give our listeners a chance to think through this process of freeze framing with us. The freeze frame is used in any stressful situation. Is that right?
That's correct.
Can you? There are five steps. Can you run through those for us?
Quite simply, what freeze frame is about is learning how to get out of the stress reaction. And reaction in and of itself means no choice. You say something, I react. To get out of the stress reaction into a place in our lives where we can actually make far more efficient choices with our energy. And we're always spending our energy mentally and emotionally, as well as physically. So what we teach people is how to first recognize that they're in stress around a particular issue. Then to disengage from that stress, to literally shift their focus from the racing mind and the disturbed emotions to a place of at least neutrality in the heart. Then to consciously engage the power of what I'd call the power of positive feeling, because we've seen in the research that it's the shift in a feeling state that creates electrophysiological changes and hormonal and immunological changes as well. This is a key to opening up a different layer of insight built into our system. So a change in the feeling state to a heart frequency or heart feeling, deep sensitive heart feeling, right in the middle of the stress. And then to seek one's own guidance, one's own intuitive guidance about what is the best way to deal with that solution, and then to act on that solution. So it's really learning to shift from the disturbed mind and emotions to a place of balance and poise that is really within us, to a place of that gives us a different perception on things that allows us to make choices instead of just mechanically reacting to life and people and places and things and events.
I want to take that apart. You said the first thing you do is to teach people to recognize a stressful moment. The first thing I thought when I read about these steps is, so frequently we don't know a stressful moment until we're down the hall muttering about it or right in the middle of a flame-flowing argument. I mean, it's just until we get beyond it or it's too huge. So how do you catch up with yourself, or do you?
Well, that would be a fine time to catch up with yourself in the middle of your becoming a flamethrower. But certainly as we become more practiced with this tool, we can see it coming before it gets to the explosion stage, because by then plenty of research shows that that's a very toxic event in our bodies when we get to the sort of explosion. And certainly freeze frame is not about suppressing or repressing feelings or emotions. It is about transforming them. And that's power. To not be tooled around. So that's the first part of the equation. So it doesn't matter when. It might be, you know, a half second later, it could be a half day later, it could be half a year later, by the time you finally say, I've had enough of this, I want to shift. And as people use the tool in various contexts, the time between the initial stress reaction or the stress event and when we decide to use the tool becomes shorter and shorter. Mm-hmm. So the detrimental effects on our physiology also becomes less as we become more practiced.
This is a practice. This is an exercise. Why? I mean, I think I understand this, but tell me, why stop and go to your heart? Is this partly to disengage the raging bull?
That is partly to disengage the raging bull. It's also, as I said earlier, electrically, the heart really is 40 to 60 times more powerful than the electrical energy being emitted by the brain in the EEG. And to shift, well, quite simply, people live for the moments when their hearts come alive. We all do. 5-year-olds and 85-year-olds, uneducated people and highly educated people all want the same thing. We want to feel fulfilled. And we experience fulfillment in the heart. It's when we go, that's why I'm alive. That's what I want. And that's really a heart experience. What we've seen in the research is when people have those experiences, there's remarkable changes happening in the ECG signal in the heart, literally. And especially when you look at it in the spectral analysis, you can see profound changes happening in the shape of those waves, in the electrical content, knowing full well that this is being radiated to literally every cell in the body. So what we think and feel is having immediate physiological consequences. So why shift from the head to the heart? One, it is to disengage from the raging bull and the disturbed emotions. But two, to tap into a part of ourselves that does really have solutions and choices.
Okay, now tell me how to do that. When the bull is racing, raging, in charge.
Well, a good example would be, you know, the traffic jams of life. And we've all been in them. And there's some days when you're stuck in the traffic jam, when you're late for a meeting and you're frustrated and you're irritated and you can just feel that hormonal stew brewing inside your own body. You just feel anxious and upset and, you know, wish the traffic would move, but it's not moving and so you're just stuck. And so there's that stressful moment. We've also had other days when we've been stuck in the traffic jam when, for some reason, we've had a great deal of poise and we understand the traffic's not going to move till it moves, no need to get upset about it. You know, yeah, this is not fun that I'm stuck here, but it's not a total disaster either. It'll move sometime. So between those two places, we can see sort of a head reaction, which is, I must get there now at all costs, even though the traffic's not moving. We're still running that energy through ourselves and toxifying ourselves. And the other one where we're dealing with the situation, making peace with it, adapting, and using our energy as efficiently as we can. Maybe we turn on the radio. Well, there's lots of traffic jams in life. It could be a person who's your traffic jam. Every time you see them, you go through that same irritation reaction. When you shift to the heart, and we do this, as I mentioned, in the steps, first disengaging from, I don't like this person, this is really bothering me, stop, step back, consciously shift your focus into the heart center, consciously engage a feeling of care for anybody, not necessarily this person. It could be, I'm so appreciative that I have this lovely kitty at home, because every time I go home, it feels nice to pet it, and it loves me, and I love it. And that's a nice part of my life, and I appreciate that, and I'm glad it's there. And simply in turning my focus to that event at the feeling level takes me out of the damaging, unmanaged emotionality of feeling resentful to this person who started me off on this journey of irritation. And from that place, I can see that there may be other options of how I can deal with this person. Maybe it's time for me to speak my truth. Listen, I'm irritated about X, Y, and Z, but not as an attack, but just really a desire to communicate and clean it up. Or maybe the better thing is to just leave this person alone, let them be who they are, and recognize that maybe we can't coexist as friends, but I don't have to judge them and make them less than. I can just let them live in their world and I can live in mine. And that's more energy efficient than reacting every time I see them. So there's a number of options that may come up from my own common sense. And the heart really is the source of our common sense, to just demystify all of this and, you know, just make it quite simple. Mm-hmm. It is a place that is always talking to us about what is probably the best thing we ought to do in the moment. The problem is the mind is so caught up in its own processes and it's creating so much noise that we can no longer hear the intuitive voice surfacing from our common sense. An analog would be, it's like you go out and buy a $5,000 stereo, and it's just one of the most lovely things you can listen to, and then you run the vacuum cleaner in the living room while you're trying to listen to the stereo. Then you wonder, what's wrong with the stereo? I'm not getting that pristine, lovely sound that I want to hear. We have to learn how to turn off the noise.
And I'm gathering from the way you're explaining freeze frame that this is not just something you should practice, quote, in the heat of the moment. In fact, practicing it when there is an absence of heat will prepare you better for heat-filled times.
Absolutely. And it's also something that can take what is already good in our lives and add more value to it. For example, if you have a lovely conversation with your child, say in the morning before you go to work, you know, to even go deeper on appreciating how precious and wonderful that is adds even more value to something that just happened. It is, while it's very powerful in addressing and neutralizing the effect of stress, it is equally powerful in taking something that's already positive and fulfilling and giving it even more depth and value and meaning. So it has both purposes, and you're right. The more one practices, sort of like weightlifting, you know, you strengthen your mm-hmm. muscles just a little bit, and then in an emergency, you have the strength to do whatever is necessary. Not, you know, hoping there won't be emergencies, but no, the steady practice of small weights and doing repetitions has made you stronger. So if you do need to lift a heavy box, well, you've got the strength to do it without hurting yourself.
This is also very meditative in nature. When you talk about freeze frame, the image in my mind is the movie slowing down to one frame on the screen. You're expanding the possibilities of the moment you're in, or at least expanding the what you can see on the screen because you've slowed it down to, yes?
That's correct. You know, right now for most people, life feels like a fast frame or fast forward. It's going very, very fast. And so consequently, we're missing a lot of things. And just, I mean, this is one of the ways that the information revolution has caught most of us. There's so much information flowing in and out of our lives. So as we're in fast forward. So freeze frame allows you to actually stop, step back, assess. Not unlike taking a timeout in a basketball game where, you know, the other team's scoring point after point and your team is just getting whipped. And you know you need a break to sort of not only rest, but to revise your strategy, to maybe get a new rhythm going for yourself, and literally to change the movie of how the rest of the game's going to go. And if you don't take that freeze frame break, odds are you're not going to be able to change it. And if you are going to try to change it, it may not be a very poise-filled process. It may be more of a painful process or struggle. But if you take the time to freeze frame, then you get a chance to slow frame.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can slow life down at that process from the inside out, even though life is going fast on the outside, but the poise allows you to move slowly while doing a lot of stuff quickly, but with the same kind of quality and attention and care that you can give as if it were going slowly. So freeze frame allows you to do all of that thing. It's a major perspective adjuster. It's a major shift in how we make decisions and on what kinds of choices we make in the moment. And it's a way of diffusing stress right as it's happening, as you get more practice. Right now, most people accumulate and accumulate and accumulate their stress and wait for the 2 weeks at the end of the year to download it. What we're saying is you can start downloading, transforming that stress before you go home each day, right as the stress is happening. You don't even have to wait for the 5 o'clock workout or the jog to download it. You can be doing it right as it's happening, maintaining a place of poise, which also reflects great care for yourself and other people, and creating a kind of harmonious inner environment, biologically speaking, and also a much more harmonious outer environment in our interactions with people.
Has association with heart math and with techniques like freeze frame changed you in ways that you can articulate?
Oh, I think quite profoundly. I probably come from a school that many people relate to, which is sort of the overachieving, highly driven, and sometimes oblivious to other people in the process kind of model. Not intentionally, but because I have a lot of passion for a lot of things, sometimes that passion has overtaken the needs of people around me. And so in the process of being an overachiever, I have not always been as sensitive to other people's needs, sort of a prima donna even at times.
Mm-hmm.
Slowing down into the freeze frame has allowed me to still be as productive, in fact even move to a new threshold of personal excellence, while at the same time building much, much stronger and much more sensitive relationships with all the folks around me at the personal level, at the professional level, at all levels, at the training level, to be much more conscious, much more aware that we're all in this process together, that it's not a I win, you lose game, but it's that we all can win. It's sort of a new community taking shape, and this is the community of human beings, the community in each organization, the community in each division that we work in, actually. You know, if you think about taking work out to the military as we do, the military sees themselves as a family. Well, some would say a very dysfunctional family. We are helping them clarify what their objectives are and deal with the very large-scale changes that have happened in their worlds. They're downsizing. They're having people have joined, and they're now being told that they don't have jobs anymore. There's profound changes happening. And it's been a great joy to be able to bring this kind of service to them, and not in that same old way of, you know, I know something that you don't, but from a perspective of saying that as I follow my heart, I learn things about myself that can be useful to you and your processes of creating organizational change and interpersonal shifts, so that, yeah, the reality is people are going to have to go, but how can we do that with as little stress and as little dislocation as possible?
On your bio, it says you worked with officers on Elmendorf, which is just outside of Anchorage. I was struck when I read that, and struck again when you just mentioned military. It seems to me that we conceive of the military as a very head-driven organization, not a heart-driven organization. In fact, when you think of military, you think, well, you can't lead with your heart because you can't afford to lead with your heart. And yet that some part of that organization has welcomed in the teaching from Heart Math. Is that interesting to you? Was it a remarkable event when they called, or is this something you see happening in pockets all over the country, regardless of what kind of pocket that is?
Well, it is something that's happening in more than pockets. It's happening in very profound ways in institutions and organizations all over the country. And yes, it was also intriguing that we got a chance to, and do have a chance now, to work with so many different aspects of the U.S. military. In one sense, it's not so surprising, because what will make a soldier lay down his life is not always necessarily God and country. It's his friends in his immediate vicinity that he will give his life for or take bullets for. And of course, God and country are why he's there in the first place, or she's there in the first place. However, the military, I think, has been very receptive to this, because they are looking for things like unit readiness, the quality of their fighting teams. And if those are compromised because of infighting and the divisiveness that comes from unresolved irritations and frustrations, that can totally compromise how ready and how unified a group is. That's deadly to their organization. So it is in their best interest to deal with these issues. And of course, you've probably heard, like many people have, of the tremendous increase in violence in military families, the rise in military suicides, the very great and disturbing numbers of drug and alcohol abuse and addiction. So these are all very strong markers suggesting that not everything is well in the U.S. military, and that people are hurting, and they don't have the tools as yet to begin to address those needs in a fundamental way. And I think many officers and program leaders have recognized that there is this need, and that the Institute and its research, its scientific basis for this work of talking about the heart, which in other contexts could sound very soft, mm-hmm. but with having such credible and tight research, gives them a premise around which to help people who really need the support and the training, unify themselves on the inside. You know, the first community is the inner community, our hormonal system, immunological system, and all that. And then to deal with the military community at large, whether it's a platoon, whether it's a base, whether it's a whole service branch, whether it's the whole armed forces. And we will, as time goes on, have a deeper and deeper effect and service for the U.S. military. I've come to have extraordinary amount of respect and affection for the people. I was recently in Pearl Harbor working with U.S. Marines, and I watched what this technology did for them in a very short period of time, taking them from tremendous cynicism to saying, this really helped me with my family. This really helped me clear up some things with my, you know, my teammates on this unit, with my supervisors, with my sergeants, with my majors, and so on. So I'm seeing tremendous efficacy in taking this forward so that they can be stronger and help our nation be stronger. Mm-hmm.
This is Joseph Sundram. We have a little less than 5 minutes left. And you said something with great force that I didn't follow up on a bit ago. And it was that the heart is about getting down to business. What does that mean to you? And why did that come out as forcefully as it did?
Well, in looking at how the heart takes care of business and why it gets down to business, it sort of relates to what I was saying, is that when we don't follow our inner common sense, our inner guidance, our intuition, whatever it's called, invariably it creates more work for us down the road. So, for example, it's always telling us, you know, are you sure you want to be in this relationship? Yeah, I don't think you should be here. And we're not listening because we're captivated and it's new and it's wonderful. And sure enough, we go through the process, and somewhere down the line, the heart's there saying, I told you so, you know. As we learn to listen more deeply to what it is that's truly surfacing from our own intelligence, from our own common sense, we can make decisions that serve ourselves much more profoundly, which put us in a place to be of service to other people much more profoundly. And I think that's really the ultimate mission of, as is articulated in the book Freeze Frame. It's a very simple technology that allows people to experience for themselves this shift from the head perspective of seeing things to the common sense or heart's perspective of seeing things that allows them to take things that events, issues in their lives that have been very stressful and also provided a sense of imprisonment or no way out and given them some real creative options that work. You know, no matter what else you can say about this technology, it is a technology that works, mm-hmm. which is why it's drawn so many people from Fortune 100 companies to explore this. We're working now with I won't mention who they are, but they're multi-billion dollar companies who are sending now their CEOs and CFOs. And these folks know that because they have such a clear bottom line, that care and the qualities of the heart, in fact, the whole quality movement itself, can truly get another infusion of strength from the heart of their organization, which is built on the heart of the individuals in that organization.
Nice way to conclude. Joseph Sundram, thanks very much. If you're interested in hearing more, let's just take a look at a couple of book titles, two that I've got in hand, and I'm shuffling noisily here. One is called The Hidden Power of the Heart. My memory is it came out in 1992, and it's written by Sarah Patterson, P-A-D-D-I-S-O-N, Sarah Patterson. The founder of HeartMath Institute is Doc, D-O-C, Lew, L-E-W, Childer, C-H-I-L-D-R-E. Among his books, the latest just come out in August of 94, is called Freeze Frame. A couple of others. Teen Self-Discovery is used by a school district in California, is that right?
It's actually been approved by the California Department of Education as a textbook.
And Self-Empowerment, The Heart Approach to Stress Management, also by Doc Lew Childer. Other books in their publishing company and available for distribution, and other books in the future. We've been talking to Joseph Sundram. Joseph, thank you very much for a very interesting hour.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. This is Conversations, and I hope you join me again next week.